council. And finally, we have SB 222 for its first hearing relating to smoking in certain vehicles in indoor places. First bill before us is Senate Bill 310. We do have a CS in your packet that combines some elements of a bill by Senator Duncan. We will be hearing from Senator Duncan right after the bill sponsor, Senator Jones. Senator Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee substitute bill is Senate Bill 310 that establishes a 7-member commission to hire the director of the Alaska Marine Highway System and set long-term policies, as well as give advice and recommendations on operation of the ferries. The system would remain within the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This new measure will give the Alaska Marine Highway System a more consistent management structure that will be needed to cope with the many challenges and opportunities on the system's horizon. Many serious issues will have to be dealt with in the coming years. Vessel replacement and or refurbishment, other capital investment necessities, dwindling state revenues that will impact funding for all programs, and long-range planning needs are just some of these important concerns. Replacing the director with every change in the Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities or the Governor's Office simply does not allow continuity of direction, management, or purpose. The director must be assured of the opportunity to not only implement positive changes in the system, but the time and resources to carry them out. With this in mind, Senator Duncan and I have been working on the draft committee substitute for Senate Bill 310. The new bill combines elements of Senate Bill 310 and Senate Bill 473, different measures that address the problems of disjointed long-term policy and inconsistent management of the Alaska Marine Highway System. We feel that this new legislation is a positive and achievable step towards ensuring a better management function for our ferries.
Senator Jones, one of the comments or, I guess, criticisms in the position paper of DOT was the impact on its authority to retain or to pick a director of the ferry system. That seems to be one of the sticking points, I guess, on the legislation. And I wondered if you could just comment on why you think it's necessary that the commission have the sole authority for hiring and firing the director.
Absolutely. Every time we change the director, of course, there's a new idea. And change in policies. Each director might have a different idea on how it should be managed, individual ideas on how they should be managed in the reservations area, scheduling, employee relations. You can go right on down the line, Senator, as to individual ideas how the system should be run. If we have a commission that's there day in and day out, continuity, that commission has set up policies, long-range policies on how it should be run and followed. I think when you look at a $65 million a year operation with nine vessels, with 800 employees during the peak season, I think it needs some long-term policy direction and not changes every 2 years to be run. This allows it to run a lot more efficient.
Other questions? Senator Jones, thank you very much. Senator Duncan. Senator Jones, you're welcome to come up with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on the proposed committee substitute for Senate Bill 310. As Senator Jones mentioned, he and I have been working together to address what we consider to be a couple of major issues with the Marine Highway System, and the proposed committee substitute, I think, does address those. One, of course, I think it's very important to have involvement in the overall policy direction of the Marine Highway System from those communities who are directly impacted by the operation. That includes not, of course, just Southeast, but many other coastal communities and also communities in the interior of the state who do receive direct economic benefit from the system. Secondly, I believe, and I think Senator Jones believes, that stability in management is very critical to the overall development of the system. It's very difficult to set long-range policy, to establish schedules and set tariffs, whatever else is necessary to bring about efficient operation of the system if management changes as frequently as it seems to have been changing. Of course, it can change from administration to administration. What we've seen in past years is it's been changing more frequently than that, and it's very difficult to get any management policy, long-term management policy enacted. I believe that the committee substitute does two very important things. One is it does put the commission in statute. We now have an advisory board for the Alaska Marine Highway System, but that is not in statute. That was created by administrative order only. Two or three years ago, I did have a piece of legislation in that would put it in statute. That didn't pass. However, the administration did put the advisory board in place by administrative order. What that means, of course, is that when this administration leaves office in November or December, that advisory board may disappear. The next administration, because it's not statute, may not see fit to carry forward that administrative order, so we may not even have the advisory component. So I think it's important to put the commission in statute to ensure that that local input does continue. Secondly, of course, it does give the commission much more teeth than the advisory board presently has, and the major item is the one that you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, giving the commission the authority to appoint and remove the director of the system. And I view that as being a very important component of this, because it does, I believe, will bring about stability in management. We will not necessarily see then a change in management as political winds and as state change. And I believe that is an important component of this bill. It's not, by the way, unique. It may be unique on the director level, but let me remind you that there are two departments where that decision has been made, that the appointment of the commissioner would be made by a board rather than by the executive. Department of Fish and Game, of course, the commissioner is appointed by the board, and in the Department of Education, the Board of Education appoints the commissioner. My view that the reason we do that, or handle those two departments that way, is because they both deal in areas where you need to develop a long-range, consistent policy. And if you were to change the management of the Fish and Game Department or the Department of Education as political winds change, you could not put together that long-term, consistent policy. I think there are certain other areas of state government where that's important, and this is one of those where you have a system where they do generate revenues. Their long-range policy is important as far as the efficiency of the operation of that system, and we need to try to bring some stability to management. So it's not unheard of, maybe in this state director's level, but we do have a couple of examples on the commissioner's level where it's been in place, and I think it's worked. And I would urge the committee to proceed with this, to adopt the committee substitute, and take another step, I believe, in bringing stability to the highway system.
Thanks, Senator Duncan. Questions? Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan and I aren't the only ones that feel this way. In your package, you see the Governor's Conference on Small Business also seeks fit that thinks it would be the way to go, establish a commission concerning the Laughing Highway and other parts of the DOT also.
Senator Duncan is an honorary member of the committee. Would you like to assume the usual chair on the
be happy to
platform? Is there anybody else in Juneau desiring to testify on this bill? We do have a representative from DOT. Their position paper is in the packet. So we have been, for those of you on teleconference, we have been joined by Senator Ewan. Senator Ewan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things. I guess on the composition of the board here, and I just want to make sure I understand, we've got one of the maritime representatives, a member of the Maritime Union, two residents of Southeast Alaska, and a resident of the Gulf of Alaska area west of Icy Cape. Would that be like South Central, or in other words, does it have to be somebody like from a coastal community, or what's the purpose of putting that language?
Well, that's the idea of it being in the southwest, where the ferry system does serve those communities, Cordova, Valdez.
So would think it could be anybody in that area, I assume, like Homer or Kenai or Anchorage or Manitou or something, because that's all part
right.
of the Gulf of Alaska and Cook Inlet.
That's correct. We also have, of course, have a person that represents the interests of the public from anywhere in the state.
We do have some folks on teleconference. Is there anybody in Ketchikan or Sitka desiring to testify at this time?
Mr. Chairman, neither Ketchikan nor Sitka have dialed into the teleconference.
At this time, we have Petersburg and Valdez and Randall from none of our suspects.
Is there anybody else on teleconference desiring to testify?
Yeah, this is Steve Apotsky from Petersburg. I just wanted to serve, but I think I'd like to testify just for a short comment.
Please proceed, sir.
Can you read me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, fine, yeah. I am a former employee of the ferry system back at original inception, and I would like to see the concept kept as it originally was back in the Egan days when the ships were first built, to be extensions of our state highways and part of the highway system. I don't want to see them, even with an authority or a commission or anything else, going into the love boat concept, all right? I understand tourism, but mainly I want the concept of Alaska Marine Highways kept, an extension of our road system. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is there anybody else on teleconference desiring to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there also going to be a new executive director? I thought I saw that.
New Vanguard system?
Yeah, or is that like someone who presently is going to be on board that... I don't know, I just saw a zero pistol.
I don't see, the individual doing a good job, the rest of this there, I think this gives that director an opportunity to remain there. A much better chance, I think, than if the governor changed or commissioner changed.
We didn't eliminate Mr.
Ayers by doing this. No, I understand that, but I'm just saying, in other words, will we have to hire another executive director, or will that just be assumed that that's a position that's already in the budget, and that position, that his position would be the executive director's position?
Mr. Chairman, right now we do have, I guess it's called a director of the Marine Highway System. That position would remain. The only thing that this changes is, instead of that position being appointed either by the commissioner or the governor, as a political appointee, they would be hired by the commission, just as the Board of Education hires the Commission of Education, etc. I want to respond, if I could, very briefly to the fellow from Petersburg. I'm not entirely to his question, but just to assure him that one of the things that we're trying to do here with this commission is to ensure that people like him from those communities do have some say about the direction of the Marine Highway System in the future. And this commission bill would not try to change the fact that it is supposed to be an extension of the highway system in Southeast Alaska at all, but would only try to stabilize management, of course, to ensure that there's community involvement in the development system.
There's no further testimony. We'll close the public hearing. And is there any discussion on the bill?
Yes.
Senator Adams.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I will be taking the department's position as far as what they would like to do is continue the appointment by either the commissioner or the governor. And so I think that the bill is fine with the exception of that particular section. And I think this should remain under the commissioner or the governor's appointment.
Chairman.
Senator Kelly.
My only concern with the bill is with the effective date. Why commit ourselves to 5 years of a board appointed by a governor that's only going to be around for a few months? By the time the bill passes, let's say we're into May, signed it by June 1, and you got 90 days, June, July, August, makes the appointment September, October, they meet in November. In December, the new governor takes off. Just the effective date doesn't make sense.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Duncan.
I'm trying to understand for sure what Senator, were you talking about the length of the terms of the appointments
The law becomes effective 90 days after it passes, correct? Or 90 days after it's signed.
That's correct.
And what I'm saying is the current governor who will make the appointments to the board, 5-year appointments, will be long gone by the time the thing is rolling. Why not just make it effective next January and start up on a new slate, no matter who the next governor may be?
The commissioner still serves the pleasure of the governor, that's my understanding.
Commission members serve the pleasure of governor. I understand Senator Kelly's point is there will be a new governor. Why not let him appoint a new board, but then appoint the new director? I guess that's a policy call, or it's a legitimate point. On the length of terms, the reason, at least in my mind, went to a 5-year term was to build stability so you wouldn't have the commission changing right with the governor. But that was why the length of term is 5 years. But I understand your point on the effective date, yes.
Let me put it another way. I don't anticipate that this board, even if it comes into existence in September or October, is going to change the executive director. So why not just allow the new board to make that choice? I mean, then it wouldn't be political.
So you'd suggest an effective date of January 1, 1991? Mm-hmm. Senator Jones, do you have a reaction?
Frankly, of course, I don't know who's going to win the election any more than anybody else. It's probably... Might as well let them have something to do when they get taken.
Could we get a motion to adopt the proposed CS? Senator Hill?
Mr. Chairman, I move Nash Adams.
Any objection? Senator Adams, did you have a discussion on your adoption of the CS? All those in favor of adoption of CS, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Senator Adams, no. The CS is adopted. Is there a motion to include an effective date in the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I move Nash Adams consent that Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 310 be amended to show in the title that it's an effective date of January 1st, 1991.
Is there any objection to the adoption of the amendment on the CIC?
Question. Senator Kelly would like to add after Governor or Lieutenant Governor.
You know, we pay the attention to Lieutenant Governor.
I think the Lieutenant Governor should be in charge of this division. I think it's only appropriate.
Is there any objection to the amendment? If not, the amendment to include in the CIESTA an effective date of January 1, 1991 is adopted. Is there any discussion on the bill itself?
No discussion. I had discussions with some of the people in Anchorage yesterday who came in, and I thought they had a very novel idea. We're obviously not looking at expanding the ferry system today, but there might be a possibility of doing a ferry from like Anchorage to the Mansu or a hovercraft or something like that, and that certainly would be something that could fit under the authority of something like this in the future as part of the Marine Highway System.
Anchorage to the Mansu.
Mr. Chairman,
are you ready for the motion?
Yes.
I move and ask that the substitute for Senate Bill number 310 be moved out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving the CS? If not, CS for Senate Bill 310 moves with individual recommendations.
That's a really good idea.
Of course, it's a good idea.
We'll see again. Senator Fahrenkamp's tied up in the Senate Resources Committee temporarily here. We're going to move on to SB 222, smoking in certain indoor places and vehicles. It's Mr. Christian. Yeah. Senator Fakes is the sponsor of this bill, and she's out of town unavoidably here, and we have Mr. Christensen to testify in her stead. Chris?
Mr. Chairman,
before Chris starts with testimony, we do have two amendments, and I would like him to speak to both those amendments in his testimony, please.
Have you seen those amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Great. If you could just include that, that'd be great.
For the record, my name is Charles Christensen. I'm made Senator Fakes, the sponsor of this legislation. Mr. Chairman, I'll try to be brief. Senate Bill 222 amends Alaska laws relating to smoking in certain public places. It was introduced by Senator Fakes at the request of the American Lung Association as part of their Tobacco-Free 2000 program. At the present time, approximately 20% of Americans over the age of 16 smoke cigarettes. Alaskans smoke at a rate approximately 5% greater than the national rate. Each year, smoking causes the deaths of more than 300,000 Americans. In 1985, there were estimated to be 261 smoking-related deaths in Alaska. This was 14% of the state's mortality that year. The estimated total for medical care due to smoking in Alaska in 1985 was $52.8 million. This does not take into account lost wages due to illness or losses to employers because of increased insurance premiums and absenteeism. In an effort to encourage people not to smoke and protect the health and well-being of non-smokers who must breathe secondary smoke, Alaska in 1984 passed a no-smoking law. This law is predicated on several legislative findings. First, the numerous studies have shown secondhand smoke to be a significant health hazard. Second, that recent court decisions recognize an emerging right of employees to work in a smoke-free environment. And third, that smoking results in increased costs to employers and the public in the form of more frequent absenteeism by employees who smoke and higher costs for health insurance, fire insurance, life insurance, and workers' compensation. In order to address these findings, current law specifies certain public places and vehicles in which smoking is regulated. In these specified places, smoking and non-smoking areas must be designated. Signs must be posted to accomplish this. Persons who violate the requirement to post signs or who smoke in a designated non-smoking area are subject to certain penalties. The Hess Committee substitute for Senate Bill 222 revises this law by establishing two categories of public place, those in which smoking is regulated, as with current law, and those in which smoking is absolutely prohibited. The bill takes some of the places currently on the regulated smoking list and moves them over to the new completely prohibited list. It adds several types of places not currently mentioned in the law to the regulated smoking list. And finally, it provides that a person in charge of a place on the regulated smoking list must consider only the health of non-smokers in designating a smoking area and not the convenience of smokers.
Chris, I wonder, could you just run through real quickly the places that have moved from the regulated to the prohibited and then the ones that have been added to the prohibited just by place?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. On the regulated smoking list, we have added post-secondary educational institutions and adult daycare facilities. Current law was interpreted only to apply to secondary and elementary schools and child daycare facilities. The Hess Committee substitute also added correctional facilities and pioneers' homes to the regulated area list. In terms of absolutely at places where smoking is absolutely prohibited, the list includes any public or private elementary or secondary schools or children's daycare facilities. It includes a a room, chamber, or other place under the control of the state or a political subdivision of the state while a public meeting or public assembly is in progress. Currently, smoking is regulated in those areas. It's not absolutely prohibited. It includes public or private laboratories or offices associated with dental care, health care, or the healing arts, and a public or private hospital or other non-residential health care facility. Currently, those places are on the regulated smoking list, not the absolutely prohibited list. And it, that's basically what the lists are, Mr. Chairman. There are two technical problems with the bill as it was passed out by the House Committee I'd like to bring to this committee's attention. The committee made a number of changes, and in so doing, caused two minor technical problems. On page 3, starting at line 28, the bill reads, "This subsection does not apply to the person in charge of a store that sells only tobacco products and related articles." This language was in the original bill because the original bill said that any commercial establishment, such as a bank or a store or a shopping mall, had to designate smoking and non-smoking areas. And section 5 of the bill also provided that a person who has to designate a commercial establishment as a smoking area could not designate the entire place as a smoking area. Those two provisions were taken out of the bill, so there's no longer any reason to provide an exemption for tobacco shops. That particular line simply makes no sense in the Hess Committee substitute. The second problem, if you look on page 6, line 2, it says AS 1835-320B is repealed. This is a provision of current law which states that the rules chairman is responsible for designating smoking and non-smoking areas in space under the control of the legislature. Now, the original bill, as it was passed, absolutely prohibited any smoking in any state-owned or rented facility. So there was no reason to give the rules chairman the authority to designate smoking areas in a Capitol building or in our interim space if it was absolutely prohibited there. The Hess Committee did away with the complete prohibition of smoking in state facilities. Therefore, 1835-320B should not be repealed because the rules chairman still will need the authority under the Hess Committee substitute to designate smoking areas.
Well, Senator Kelly, am I led to believe then that we're prohibiting smoking in all state facilities except the Capitol building?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, the original bill would have prohibited all smoking in any state facility, including the Capitol. The Hess Committee substitute simply says that in any state facility, including the Capitol, smoking must be regulated. Smoking and non-smoking areas must be designated.
That wasn't my interpretation. I thought that it was under the sectional analysis, I thought it was that under the prohibited areas, that their chambers or rooms or other places under the control of the state or political subdivision of the state, I assume including the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, there are two separate provisions which affect the legislature. One is the section which deals with government-owned facilities, and the other is the provision which deals with rooms in which a political meeting is being held. The absolute prohibition on smoking in rooms in which meetings are being held is retained in the Hess version, but the absolute prohibition on smoking in any part of a government building has been eliminated.
So you could smoke maybe in the hallway, you could smoke in your office, but you couldn't smoke in the hearing room.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, under the Hess Committee substitute. Therefore, the repealer for 1835-320B needs to be taken out so that the rules chairman can designate what parts of this building, other than meeting rooms, smoking is allowed in office.
Other questions?
I have
Senator Dillon.
What about in the case of an airport, what will it do to smoking and non-smoking sections of the airport?
Through the chair, Senator Ewing, current law says that smoking must be regulated by the designation of smoking and non-smoking areas in a waiting or boarding area for a vehicle of public transportation, including aircraft flights. And this does not change that. One way it affects aircraft is current law says that smoking and non-smoking areas may be designated on interstate aircraft flights. This adds interstate aircraft flights.
But
as a practical measure, is there any smoking going on in interstate airline flights today?
Again, through the chair, Senator Kelly, my understanding is that of the many, many thousands of flights per day, there's only 20 left in the United States that any smoking is allowed on. I think it's flights greater than 6 hours a night. So it's a practical matter there. Really is now.
How would we, understood it, unless they change, well, perhaps Northwest's direct flight to Detroit might be longer than 6 hours. We may have one or two of those, but most of them are through Minneapolis or Seattle, which don't exceed the 6 hours. But do we have control to regulate interstate airline
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that we can regulate it to the extent that the FAA allows the state to, and the FAA has allowed states to enforce. Well, for example, with this law in effect, I believe DEC, if a person smokes, is caught smoking on an interstate or interstate flight, a DEC officer could write a ticket. The person could be cited and prosecuted in our courts. They wouldn't have to be done by the federal aviation authorities. In a federal
over
our airspace.
You know, Mr. Chairman, you know if the Supreme Court has ever ruled on airspace questions in regard to, you know, if flights are going over Alaska and we want to tax alcohol and beverage on international flights just because they're flying over in Alaska airspace, has that ever been looked at by the Alaska Supreme Court?
Through the chair, Senator Billing, I'm not certain.
Do you think enforcement might be tough with 35,000?
I think there have been cases involving alcohol. In fact,
there was a test case in Wisconsin where they actually ruled that they could actually tax all the alcohol that was, you know, that was on board, even if they're flying over the state and not landing, which I thought was interesting.
I think what my understanding was that was for intrastate flights that were within Wisconsin. Other questions, Mr. Christensen?
Yes, I've got two amendments I wanted to just look at and comment, both positive and negative, on sponsor, how she feels on both amendments.
Mr. Chairman, starting with amendment number 2 by Senator Adams, the bill before you would prohibit smoking in any sort of office or facility associated with the healing arts. It would prohibit it in hospitals or doctor's offices. This amendment would have the effect of not absolutely prohibiting in smoking in facilities associated with mental health. So, for example, if a person were visiting their psychiatrist, they could smoke in their psychiatrist's office while they were undergoing treatment. The psychiatrist or the person controlling the mental health facility would retain the legal authority to designate a smoking or non-smoking area in their facility. And Senator Fix thinks this is a very reasonable amendment. And her original intent was only to affect the physical healing arts, not the mental healing arts, in terms of the flat prohibition. Amendment number 2, Mr. Chairman, by Senator Adams, has the effect of, let me step back a minute. This bill, the current law says that that a smoking area for students may not be designated in a school, an elementary or secondary school. However, you can have smoking areas for adults in schools. This bill simply prohibits any smoking on the grounds of any secondary or elementary school by anyone, whether it's a student or a teacher or other staff member. The effect of this amendment is to say that any collective bargaining agreement supersedes that prohibition. So if a school district entered into a contract agreement with a teacher's union and the contract said the teachers have the right to smoke in their lounge, this prohibition wouldn't apply to that extent. Senator Fakes, the bill as it now stands probably would not change collective bargaining agreements that are currently in force, because the Constitution says that the legislature can't pass laws which impair contracts. Senator Fakes thinks that's certainly reasonable to grandfather in current collective bargaining agreements. Her preference is to simply ban it once those current contracts run out. However, she certainly would defer to the judgment of the committee in that matter.
But there would not be, my first comment would be that, well, are there analogous situations with state employees? But my understanding is that state buildings, per se, are still designated, non-designated.
Mr. Chairman, under the bill, that's correct. Although I think my understanding is that, for example, the Department of Administration doesn't allow smoking in a number of state facilities now because it's too expensive to set up smoking areas.
What about marijuana? So presumably they wouldn't be... I don't think, you know, I'd be very leery about opening the door for that being something that could be bargained by all employee unions.
Mr. Chairman, as the amendment is proposed, it only affects collective bargaining for smoking in a school. The bill does completely prohibit any smoking, for example, in a hospital. And the exemption isn't made for hospital employees who are members of unions to collectively bargain against the right to smoke.
Other questions, Mr. Christensen? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else desiring to testify on this bill? Senator Perrin-Camp.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I couldn't help while waiting here to address my legislation to come in and testify against this legislation. I really think that when you raise a fine 600%, you're just getting a little gung-ho. And I'd like to know what the cost will be in are we going to prohibit any state employees from being smokers? Because what this will do is say they either have to go outside, which you're not going to allow the teachers to do now because you can't smoke on a school ground. So if you've got a smoker, they've got to alleviate smoking. Either teachers can't smoke, period, or they've got to do away with smoking from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, or leave the grounds. It just doesn't make sense to me. State employees are going to have to go stand out in the snow or 40 below or whatever if they're smokers, or you don't hire any more state employees, or they're suffering. It's just, I guess what you have to do is just when you get a dog down, beat him. And I'm very much against the legislation.
We should outlaw smoking. Thank you, Senator Karen Kemp. I would just note that in Anchorage, there are people standing outside the Hill Building in below zero weather smoking.
I've got a lot of
Is there anybody else that desires to testify on this bill? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Potter, and I'm testifying on behalf of NEA Alaska and testifying in opposition to this bill. We see that the sections that pertain to certain buildings where smoking is absolutely prohibited diminishes the right of employees and their unions to negotiate complete working conditions for their members. And we believe that working conditions, including adequate places for coffee breaks and smoke breaks for those who are so inclined, are appropriate. And we wish to see these collective bargaining rights over these working conditions continued and enforced, notwithstanding what Senator Fake's interpretation of what the law means sans any election, any words about teacher, well, labor contracts.
How would that work if there were continued to be smoking areas in, I guess, in the lounges? We've all toured a lot of schools, particularly elementary schools in our districts, and at least in Anchorage, there's usually just one room that's kind of a combination lunch room, break room. How does that work? Do you see a problem of smokers vis-a-vis non-smokers that are in the same room?
Well, there are two basic models, well, maybe three, two or three basic models that exist. Where there's a single, frankly, room, one model has it adequately ventilated, and there's kind of a civilized understanding that the smokers sit somewhere near the exhaust fan and the non-smokers can sit wherever they want to. Another model is separate faculty rooms for smokers and non-smokers. That, of course, is quite self-explanatory. The ones who don't want to be around smoke go to the non-smoking one, and the others go to the smoking one. And then the third one is, third model, is that there is a faculty room that's considered non-smoking, and by some kind of informal agreement, the committed smokers go somewhere else to smoke, like the furnace room or storage room or something of that nature.
Now, how would you envision that working under contract negotiations? Do you think that it would be more likely that they would be wanting to secure rights to smoke in the same lunchroom lounge, or that that they would be designated the furnace room or storage room for smoking?
Well, in real life, I think a lot of it has to do with the numbers involved. And if it's a staff of 45 people and there's only one smoker, I suspect that one smoker may want to, rather than insist on a faculty room of equal size with the non-smokers, might choose to take a less desirable space.
I'm having a hard time picturing that in collective bargaining agreements, so, I mean, we're not talking about school-by-school decisions, are we?
Well, there certainly can be. Most of the modern management thought is that schools do better in all ways if most management decisions are left up to the local site.
So it could be something that could be structured school by school.
Yes.
As opposed to everybody has an unalienable right to smoke in a teacher lounge.
That is correct.
The last question, I'm not trying to be real sanctimonious about this, but there always arises the question of role models. and the behaviors of teachers around pupils, and we spend, I think, sometimes inordinate time around here trying to pass laws and resolutions outlining certain behaviors, and lately, of course, alcohol consumption and tobacco consumption have been highlighted in some of our actions. And, you know, we spend money and we do these laws and resolutions trying to set up educational programs or preventative programs for drug and alcohol, including tobacco use of young people. Do you think that there's a public purpose to be served in trying to strongly encourage, I guess, teachers not to smoke in schools for this, for the example purposes?
I think it's unrealistic to expect public school teachers and other public school employees to be perfect role models for all students. You know, in spite of what we tell students about, you know, it's not wise to smoke, it's not wise to drink, it's not wise to have recreational sex and so forth, they're going to pretty much do whatever it is they grew up knowing what is right and what's wrong in the home. I find it very difficult to envision a teacher who is a perfect role model on to use my example, on smoking and drinking and eating habits. Certainly obese teachers could be held up as improper role models. I don't believe that teachers can be a perfect role model for all people.
Senator
Kelly. Ben, I don't remember seeing the inside of a lounge in the 16 years I spent in school or whatever. We never got in the lounge, and I doubt if the kids observed their teachers smoking. What would be worse than that is the teachers that have to sneak off the school ground to have a cigarette. Not only is that non-productive, but kids are going to know what's going on.
Of course, my reading would be, I tend to agree with that problem, but my reading would be that it may not be off the school grounds, it may just be outside the building. You know, I think it's the building itself, so you might have might be smoking on the edge of the playground during recess, so which I see too, that's a problem. That's more of a problem from the role model.
So then, I suppose you should let them smoke in the lounge or a designated area where the kids can't see.
Other questions? Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else desiring to testify? Do we have anybody on teleconference desiring to testify on 222?
We should invite the kids down here to one of our adjournment parties.
Yeah. I think some of us did want to do it. Mr. Splinter, we'll close the public hearing. We do have a couple of amendments. Amendment number one by Senator Adams. Senator Adams?
Yeah. Which one you start with, the provisions about collective bargaining supersedes the prohibition in this paragraph?
Could you just assure me that I'm reading this right? It's meant to be a complete sentence, but it's just a clause after the word located on line 28. Is that how you read that? Or
at the end of the line 28?
So it's just a clause. It's not a new sentence.
That's correct.
Did you move amendment number one?
Sure. I'll move amendment number one.
The
only reason I'm objecting is this going to take care of the NEA's concerns? Is this going to take care of the NEA's concerns?
I believe, basically, I'm not going to speak for them, but I think they would like the whole bill dead, if not something like this, to work in their collective bargain. But if the bill can come back.
Sir?
Senator Adams, yes, that is a correct conclusion. We would like to see it dead, but if not, we would like to protect the rights of our workers to have a hand in controlling the working conditions and the use of workspace.
Okay, so you support the amendment. Thank you. I'll remove my objection.
I'm going to object for another question here. And again, this is kind of construction here. By adding it the way you do, provisions of collective bargaining agreements supersede prohibitions, are you intending that only apply to elementary or secondary school, preschool, or children's daycare facility, or all of these things where you might have workers engaged in collective bargaining?
Mine was in all areas, an area that is designated as smoking, where it will be allowed.
So presumably you could have daycare workers also negotiating for that.
Well, now, wait a minute. Existing contracts are one thing. but I don't believe collective bargaining agreements should supersede the law. The law is the law. If somebody has a collective bargaining agreement now, that's one thing, but to open it up for anything in the future, it's the most important thing.
So what is your intent?
Whether we have a collective bargaining now, that can continue, right? That's fine. I have no problem with that.
So you would be willing to clarify your amendment to talk to existing collective bargaining agreements?
That's correct.
Is that your understanding? Is there objection to the amendment premised on that it would
There's
be...
an objection.
Are they on the committee?
No.
Sir, did you have another comment?
Yes, if it's phrased that way, only dealing with the existing collective bargaining agreements, then we would have to go on record as opposing that amendment as well. A lot of our locals didn't know that this was coming down and didn't already have my board policy, smoking area rights, and therefore didn't pursue them in a collective bargaining agreement, and this would catch them all by surprise.
Okay, so I guess what I meant was existing areas like schools where there's a collective bargaining already in agreement, they could continue to collective bargain. But if an area that doesn't already have collective bargaining agreements, they shouldn't be allowed to open up this as a new area.
Well, that's my feeling, and that's why I asked the original question about whether or not this was to apply to, in essence, schools as opposed to other facilities.
Schools. Okay, I don't get that.
Okay, so if we can get some license here to adopting an amendment that would be applying only the school portion of this to collective bargaining agreements, is there an objection to that amendment? Not amendment number one is adopted. Amendment number two, Senator Adams?
Yes. I'll move number two. It's basically it. What it does is must designate smoking and non-smoking areas with page 2, line 6 there. And page 3, line 6 is that amendment does is smoking areas are not banned. They are designated. That's basically what it does. And that's supported also by the sponsor.
That was my understanding from Senator Fitz. Is there any discussion on amendment number two? Is there any objection to the adoption of amendment number two? If not, amendment number two is adopted. Is there any discussion on the bill?
No. Are we going to adopt the two technical amendments that Chris pointed out to us?
I'm sorry. Right. And do we have those in writing here? I can't remember whether I saw them or not.
No, Mr. Chairman, we don't.
Okay, could you point those out to us one more time?
Certainly. On page 3, line 28, beginning with the word this. This subsection does not apply to the person in charge of a store that sells only tobacco products and related articles. That should be deleted.
Is there a motion to that effect?
So moved.
It's been moved to delete the last sentence beginning on page 3, line 28. Is there any objection? If not, we'll adopt that amendment.
And then, Mr. Chairman, on page 6, line 2, section 15 should be deleted from there.
Is there a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Any objection to adopting the amendment to delete on line 2, page 6, section 15? If not, we'll delete that. Is there a motion to incorporate those changes into a new state affairs CS?
I would move that, Mr. Chairman.
Any objection to the adoption of a new state affairs CS? Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Calhoun.
Chairman, I move the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection? If not,
object.
Yep. Kind of Adams.
Should we wait to hold the CS till a sponsor comes in?
Let me just put it as a courtesy to Senator Fix. We'd be more than happy to hold the bill pending approval of the CS, or if you would like, we will adopt it conceptually and move it on.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Fix would prefer.
So, do we move from committee with individual recommendations? No, we've got one more, and right in the nick of time, Senator Perrenkamp. We are, Senator Perrenkamp, please. We're back to SB 485. We've had the bill up before. We had a few questions raised, and we had allowed the Department of Administration to review the bill. Senator Perrenkamp.
Okay, thank you, Mr. President. Are we on teleconference again, Mr. Chairman? No. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betty Perrenkamp, Mr. Kay. What we're trying to do in this bill, and I have written stuff, so I guess maybe I better just say it that way, but let's get a little bit of control of what's happening with our Telecommunications Information Council. What we'd like to do is involve other state agencies through this TIC, or Telecommunications Information Council, and establishing the rates that are charged for the use of the computer, telephone, other services that are provided by the Division of Information Services. We want to encourage the TIC and the Department Administration to realistically plan for the state's future information services needs, so that we don't have constant crisis management. We want to be able to enable the department to budget for future needs. We empower them to build into their rates an amount that budgets for the replacement of fixed assets. There are several layers of oversight that go into this process. Right now, we have very little, if any. In the process, the TIC must approve the rates. The legislature must appropriate any estimated balances after paying for the cost of providing the services being billed to the Information Services Fund, or the ISF. And the Department of Administration must include in its budget proposal to the legislature any proposal to spend funds that are allowed to accumulate in the ISF. We see this as responsible management in light of the declining oil revenues. It allows the state to plan for increased demand zone and obsolescence in its information resources. It eases the budgeting process and involves the legislature and the other departments in large equipment purchases. Perhaps the most compelling argument for this arrangement is that we are not giving any agency more authority to spend money. We are, in fact, gaining more control over how the money is spent for these capital purchases. Right now, in many instances, when the administration needs to replace computer equipment, it does not rely on the legislature for a capital appropriation. It pays for the equipment it needs through interagency transfers of funds and buys the equipment on a lease purchase arrangement. There are no requirements such as in this bill. Which would impose a separate account for these interagency receipts. And we all know the results of the audit that was done concerning those receipts. There are no requirements that there be oversight by the TIC when the department sets the rate for the services it provides. There's nothing that requires that the legislature approve multi-million-dollar purchases if the purchases aren't made with a capital appropriation. Perhaps a case in point is, make it real clear what we're after. In the past 2 weeks, the Information Services Council, an informal working group that acts as an advisory capacity to the Division of Information Services, has been wrestling with a decision about what kind of new mainframe computer to buy for the Anchorage Data Center. Note that the question is not whether to buy the new computer, but what kind of new computer to buy. The two most likely options cost $2.9 and $3.9 million, with total five-year cost being $4.9 million and $4.5 million, respectively. This purchase will be made with interagency receipts. There's no argument among the agencies that this new computer is drastically needed. There's no argument among the agencies that the money can be raised. There's only question of what kind of computer to buy, and it's not through the budgeting process of capital budgets. So what we're trying to do is just know where these receipts are, what rates are being set, and have the agencies' rates are being set against them as a part of that rate-setting process, and get some control over the purchasing through the budgeting process.
Thank you, Senator Bernkamp. Oh, we're not on teleconference. And this does, you feel, directly respond to the budget audit recommendation for the establishment of this internal service fund and a much tighter accounting system.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do.
Are there questions to the bill sponsor?
Senator Adams? Yes. Does she have a copy of my amendment, amendment number one?
Mr. Chairman, we're adding. We're not talking about this.
No.
I would have to have you ask the information services people, but Senator Adams, it's my opinion that this would completely gut the intention of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree with that, but I will wait till after the administration have a chance to make their presentation.
Other questions of the bill sponsor?
Senator Frank Camp, thank you very much. You're welcome to join us.
Thank you, I am. Thank you very much. I'll leave Joan here if you have questions. She's very familiar with them.
Do we have a representative from the Department of Administration? Just one.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee, my name is Sue Plummer. I'm Special Assistant to Commissioner Baxter in the Department of Administration. And I'm here today to let the committee know that the department does indeed enthusiastically support this bill. And we would very much like to see it go into law.
Did you get religion from the last time we met?
We got, yeah. I guess we could leave it at that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Feel free to address yourself, and then if you could address yourself to the amendment.
I will. Thank you. The department, as you know, is responsible for state government's computing and telecommunications functions. And we're vitally interested in improving our ability to manage information resources. Prior to the budget and audit report, we were already investigating ways on how we could improve on that. It's real important to us that we have appropriate tools, that we have appropriate management, and that we have appropriate laws in order to operate as best we can in providing services to our computing and telecommunications customers, other state agencies. And it's for that reason that we support this bill. And we believe that the increased participation on the Telecommunications Council by additional legislative members and public members is a good idea. We endorse that as well. We very much support the idea and desire an establishment of an internal service fund. And indeed, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee recommended that, and we welcomed that. We view this fund as being very similar to the Highway Working Capital Fund and having similar benefits. Some of those benefits are the ISF will link information services revenues and expenditures and make them much more visible. Fees and surcharges for information services will undergo a thorough review and approval process by the customer agencies of the services that the department provides. Requests for services and the expenditures of funds to satisfy customer service requests, especially for the major hardware and software acquisitions that are so necessary to run data centers, for example, will be identified in Telecommunications Information Council approved plans and will be clearly defined and visible in the annual budget process. Finally, the department did research the concept of ISFs, internal service funds, extensively, and this was even prior to the legislative audit report, and this is the reason that we welcomed that recommendation, because we were familiar with the concept and saw the benefits. In fact, we found out from 18 other states that we contacted that 15 of those states already had ISFs with combined telecommunications and computing responsibilities accounted for in the fund, and all of them had one or the other, either a computing or a telecommunications ISF. So there seems to be a trend across the nation, and I think this is because to establish ISFs, and I think this is greatly has greatly to do with the fact that, of course, information resource management is needed more and more because the technology is advancing more and state governments, for example, are using the technology more and it's changing rapidly. With me today, Deputy Commissioner Gary Bader is here to lend his support and answer any questions, and our Division Director Paul Monette is here with his Deputy Jack Farnoli, who is indeed charge of the planning section of the division, and of course will find this improvement in the law very useful. And so they're here to answer any questions the committee might have, and with that concludes my remarks.
I have a couple questions, but first, if you could address yourself to the amendment. Have you seen the amendment by Senator Adams?
Yes, and I believe that the department would have to concur with Senator Farenkamp. It's our understanding that the amendment would in part defeat the purpose of establishing this type of fund.
Well, Senator Kelly,
what is the purpose of this type of fund? Why should there be surplus funds?
I don't think, and I would like to defer to Deputy Commissioner Bader, but I'll start by saying, and then I think he needs to add to what I might say, Senator. I don't think we would view this as surplus funds. We would view this as a fund that gives us the ability to continue providing the services that are needed to run, for example, data centers, without having to come back on an annual basis, for example, to the legislature requesting capital appropriations.
Excuse me, you said not come back to the legislature, right? On an annual basis, was your words.
I heard
heard that.
You heard that. I just continue.
Did I? What did I say, Ben?
No, you're doing good. Just keep going. You're speaking to my amendment. So, keep on.
I know what you're saying, Senator.
No, you said it. I was just repeating what you said.
This law will allow the legislature to always appropriate the funds. What I'm saying is it doesn't put the state government in the position of having to request capital in the capital budget, large appropriations for capital expenditures.
Yeah, I think it would be, my understanding is that, like the Highway Working Capital Fund, is that it builds up a sum of money based on internal user fees that then eventually go to replace the same equipment, in this case, computer equipment as needed, and that you don't have to end up in the capital budget each year with line items for various miscellaneous.
Yeah, but we pay for that in increased user fees. We pay for that in every budget, in every program throughout the state. They charge whatever they want to build up their own little nest, and are totally independent of the budget process.
Senator Adams.
Ms. Plummer, in the last 8 years, how much money have we put towards computerizing systems through Senator Sackett and myself as House Chairman of Finance in the last 8 years so that we wouldn't be in this position? Would you say it's $30 million?
Senator, I'm afraid I'm not in a position to tell you how much money that is. But I would recognize that the cost of technology is that there's a high price tag.
Yes, but we paid that, so we wouldn't be in this position a long time ago.
I think the emphasis on the bill includes increased oversight and increased support of planning. And because the technology has changed so rapidly, and because the use of it, computer services has increased so rapidly, that combined has basically made us not very successful or it impossible to keep up with what is needed. And I think what this bill will do is help ensure that doesn't happen anymore.
Mr. Bader, did you want to offer some comments?
If I may address the committee from here, or
we pick them up? Yeah, you're fine.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, just to clarify a couple of points. In terms of the charges that would come to the fund, I would point out to the committee that Senator Adams' concerns are shared not only by Senator Adams, by each of the client agencies that will be buying services from this fund. This bill provides a mechanism through the Telecommunications Information Council for those agencies not only to review, but to approve the charges in the are made to the user agency, and that's section 3F of the bill. So I think the concerns of Senator Adams about the possibility that the Department of Administration might charge a higher rate have begun to be addressed by that section. Also, the bill, I'd like you to envision a charging mechanism that attempts to gather from the agencies those funds necessary to provide for the operations of the division and for the replacement of equipment. And so when we talk about surplus funds, they're not really surplus, but they are reserved in effect to replace equipment that becomes either old or obsolete. I point out to the committee that in our current structure, and Senator Adams, I think, appropriately points out that over the years there have been several million dollars worth of appropriations for capital equipment. Those appropriations, by and large, I believe, have all been general fund. Through the mechanism provided by the ISF, we would have the ability to have not only general fund programs, but federal and other fund programs charge a fee that was approved by all member agencies, by all the agencies in the executive branch, and contribute to that fund for the replacement of equipment. So I submit to the committee that what we would have is the ability to, in effect, not subsidize some of the federal programs through our capital purchasing program. That's what we're attempting to do. Now, we would not spend from this fund without an appropriation. As we said, we envision the same thing as the Highway Working Capital, which the legislature either sees fit to appropriate from or not appropriate from, and if they think the fund has grown to a larger than it should be, even make adjustments as they have in the past. So that's what we're trying to accomplish with this bill, or not what the Senator's trying to accomplish and what we support. If I can respond, if in fact that you had this particular fund, then we need to keep the accountability of these guys once they clean up their accounts. But once we can do is we can do two things for them. We can extend the lapse dates on the fund if they do the accountability right, or they can reappropriate the money back to them. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think the difficulty with that is that it provides a great deal of uncertainty.
A legislative oversight on an annual basis, is that the uncertainty?
No, I think we're providing for the annual oversight through the appropriation bill. I think that would take care of that. What we have is the legislature could always choose to not appropriate if they didn't think the fund should be spent.
Frankly, the legislature could choose to appropriate it somewhere else. That's what you're trying to avoid.
Mr.
Senator Adams.
We still don't have my amendment before us. I have not made the motion to move it. I don't know.
Well, it needs more discussion.
Then we can have discussion afterwards. You can object.
Senator Adams?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move amendment number one.
First, let's adopt the CS.
So moved.
Sort of objection to adopting CS, if not the CS is before us, Senator Adams?
Then I'd move amendment number one.
Yeah.
There's objection.
Discussion?
Can I explain this? Well,
sure.
This deals with money coming to the fund through RSAs. And that's basically what they do is charge the other 19 agencies so much money. These are basically types of operating expenses. I think there's a definite need by this division regarding how much money is collecting and how much money is spent by each of the agencies. And you need to keep track of these through the budget process. And I believe that the current system for teleconference services and data processors are a mess, and as they have been in the 1980s. But I don't think these problems are, that until these problems are cleared, that it would be a mistake. I think it would be a mistake to allow the division to keep any excess funds from these RSAs, these charges from other agencies. If we allow them to keep these excess funds, we'd do three things. Decrease the emphasis on accountability from the division, and two, essentially reward the divisions for overcharging agencies. And three, as Sue Plummer stated, there would be no legislative oversight on an annual basis, as she stated here shortly. I believe that these operating funds should lap each year as all other operating items. And I think, the important part. And if we find that they clean up their accounting of this one, then we can do two things. We can either extend the lapse date of these funds or reappropriate these funds.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Young.
One question along with that is, how are we going to have to create any positions to take care of this bill, or is it going to be done with existing staff?
There are no positions associated with it.
Ms. Hope?
Can I make a point on behalf of Senator Faircamp? I think maybe one of the points that's being missed is that when the money is RSA to the Department of Administration, what happens under this bill is that the costs to provide the services are paid. And then in the section being referred to by this amendment, in the sentence that is proposed to be deleted, we say the legislature may use the estimated balance of these separate accounts, these separate RSA accounts, to make appropriations to the Information Services Fund. That's how any money gets into the fund. It has to be appropriated there, otherwise it would lapse. Our feeling about the amendment is that if you take that sentence out, it kind of it eliminates the whole point of how money gets into the Information Services Fund and how building in the replacement costs into that rate structure figure into the interplay with that ISF account.
Yeah, I was going to comment that just, you know, like with the Highway Working Capital Fund, that the idea is that we don't meet all of our capital replacement costs as they come. Rather, we build in essence, depreciation into it. Into the ongoing costs, and that when a vehicle needs replacing, when a piece of equipment or an upgrade needs replacing, you have the money built in from the use. There's also, of course, just like the Working Capital Fund, the other agencies are very concerned about the charges that their car or whatever their piece of equipment get the DOT sets the rates on. And you're going to have a lot of agencies looking, since even more agencies are involved in the Highway Working Capital Fund, you're going to have a lot of agencies looking at those rates and probably griping about those rates because they're paying them right out of their budget. I mean, so it's not like they're not being reviewed. And lastly, in response to Senator Adams, in the capital budget every year, we do line item from, as a fund source, from the Highway Working Capital, we appropriate back each year a certain amount. As a matter of fact, in that model, the problems we've had with the Highway Working Capital Fund have been exacerbated by us exerting too much oversight. We went in and dipped out a bunch of money that we saw fit 1 year from the Highway Working Capital Fund. So it is a decision that we're making every year, and we, in this thing, we would make it every year too, as to how much money would go into the fund or what would be appropriated from the fund.
So, Mr. Chairman, you're saying that Senator, we would make that decision regardless of whether we had Senator Adams' amendment on there or not? You're saying that the way the bill...
Well, there wouldn't be any money to make that decision with Senator Adams' amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if they have to lapse, but I don't like the way that sentence reads. What they're trying to say is we can only appropriate it to that fund. They can't tell a legislature that. That's what they're trying to get at. There's money here, and you can only use it for this purpose. That's not the way it works around here. We can use it for anything we want to. Now, if you don't want to lapse it to the fund, then maybe you can keep it separate, but report it to the legislature. They're just glorified program receipts. Except we're paying, the state's paying all the program receipts.
Now, are you referring to on page 2, lines 11 and 13? 11 to 13? That wasn't the way I was reading it. I was, when they said may use the balance, I guess I read that like your standard language, that you may make the appropriation, you may appropriate somewhere else.
I didn't read it like that. I don't believe that's the standard language.
It isn't.
I think they're trying to lock it into you can only use that fund for that purpose, and you can't lock the legislature into that.
Ms. Hope?
Could this maybe clarify as a compromise amendment after that? The legislature may use the estimated balance of these separate accounts to make appropriations to the Information Services Fund, semicolon, unless such an appropriation is made, these funds will lapse to the general fund, just like any other funds.
Reverse it. Lapse it first in the general funds, then reappropriate.
Unless they're appropriate. Does something like that work? I mean, if you want to just clarify.
This way they have the accountability and Senate and House finance of that fund.
It would happen anyway, but maybe that would make it clearer.
How's that sound? Well, why don't we develop that as a conceptual amendment, if it's okay with you, Senator Adams, that we would work on that sentence to, I guess what I heard was the money would lapse unless the legislature appropriates the estimated balance to the funds.
Well, no, unless the legislature appropriates.
Unless, yeah, exactly.
It doesn't have to go to the funds. I mean, I don't think constitutionally you can.
I don't think you can do this.
You can force the legislature to use it for that or nothing. The legislature can do anything they want with it. That's our power in the Constitution to appropriate it. You cannot, by statute, take away that power. Or you can't limit that power to one specific area. That's called dedicated fund.
Well, but wait a minute. What we're talking about here is like a capital budget item. I mean, we appropriate money to capital all the time. It doesn't lapse. And it just...
What we're talking about, I think, Pat, is like reappropriating program receipts.
But it's the portion that would be like capital replacement. I mean, it would be for capital. That's why they want to build up on your service charge.
How do you do it now?
You've got your whole operating costs, and then you got a piece of it. It's kind of like a sinking fund, a replacement cost, a depreciation, and that piece goes to a fund that over time builds up so that then you can go and upgrade your equipment or your...
They want to create a separate capital fund from program receipts that they can use any way they wish. That's what they want.
Right, exactly.
And I say that that's subject to the appropriation by a legislature, and the legislature doesn't have to give it to just that area. If we feel the schools need it, we'll give it to the schools.
And here's the other sentence. The department shall also separately account for any earnings of money held in the fund. That's interest earned off this money. They can do whatever they want with it.
Well, we can appropriate for other purposes.
Are there objections,
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Bader, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps the language reads that way. That certainly isn't the intent of the Department of Administration in supporting this bill. Our intent is to work exactly as Highway Working Capital Fund, and that is the limit of our intent. It occurs to us that the sentence that seems to be creating a question about what happens to these funds and whether or not they're dedicated and that's constitutional is page 2, line 11, where it says the legislature may use the estimated balance of these separate accounts to make appropriations to the fund. I think we would be comfortable just deleting that because we're not intending to, in supporting this bill, to think that the legislature have to tell the legislature what they must do in the future. Every year, the legislature makes a decision whether or not to appropriate, and we're not interested in a creative way of changing
And what if you say only the legislature can approve use of this fund, appropriate use of this fund?
I think that's exactly what was intended by that line. I think that's what the intent was in saying this, but it just
didn't come out that way, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I read it like you're saying, and like I think that you're intending that we can appropriate it to the fund.
I would take the position they can establish the fund, but only the legislature can authorize the use of it.
And we would be content with that.
Well, and you might say the legislature must authorize any appropriations to the Information Services Fund, something like that.
I wouldn't be that specific. I would say only the legislature can authorize use of this fund, because, again, the whole idea about dedicated revenues is if we need to use it for schools or we need to use it for state employee salary increases, you may just have to.
So what you would argue is use of the fund can only be made through legislative appropriation.
Yes, and I'd leave it at that, and I could live with that.
Okay.
Then you can develop the fund and come back to the legislature and say we got $2 million, we'd like to use it this way.
At the risk of delaying this, I think it'd be helpful to have this in front of us. Could we work, Joan, could you work with our administration, my staff, in restructuring this? I think that we know what we want here, but I think that people would feel a lot more comfortable if they had the language in front of them and that we revise that. I'd also suggest that we kind of dig out the highway working capital example and try to run through that a little bit. But I think maybe we need a little bit more understanding and how that works in our legislative appropriation process each year.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Adams.
And then I think we should read also the legislative audit report of last year on this division. Perhaps we need to do a summer job on this one.
Let's not look back, let's look forward. I think this whole legislation is attempting to look forward, correct?
You got to see what the problem is.
Yeah,
we
can cure.
There is the departmental response.
We only got 53 days left.
Then we can do
full time for this.
Have the interim work on this one.
There were some technical amendments that were raised. I think you should have a copy of these that were basically to make conforming amendments on the last page 3, section 5 and section 6, just changing the references 3 to 2 and 5 to 4. Why don't we go ahead and make those now, if we'd like. Senator Adams.
Mr. Chairman, did you want me to withdraw my amendment at this time?
Please. We'll come back to it.
We're going to come up with a fee substitute then bring it back to the committee, or what do you want to do?
We're going to have CS before us, including this amendment we've discussed in concept, and then if we could move this amendment before inclusion also.
I would move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Is there an objection to this amendment?
I would draw it, fine.
Thank you. And then we will adopt this amendment, put it into the CS.
Well, I would move Senator Adams' amendment be adopted in concept so that we can have a bill in front of us with it in there when we come in, I guess, Monday.
Is there any objection to Senator Adams' concept? Then we will adopt that and include it in the CS, and then Monday we'll just have it before us for action. Thank you all very much. Stay fair to turn.
Every individual, like,